Please be seated.
Good morning. Anything arising overnight? No? Very good. I see a joint witness statement was filed. Great. I haven't read it, but so that's something in and of itself, whether or not agreement or full or partial was reached. Anyway, that's been filed. So it's one conference down, two more to go, with a fourth conference for planners to see what they can make of what's there. All righty. I think, Mr. Page, we're in your hands.
Yes. It's now time to call Sally Dicey.
Excuse me, Your Honour.
Mm-hmm.
Just following up on the conversation.
Oh, sorry. Yes. We've been discussing other things this morning. How much time does he need?
Well, he was thinking he would file it after the planning conference, which would be the 9th of April.
No. Isn't that just going to confuse things? We've got to have all planners coming back anyway after the planning conference, picking up, if you like, the product of the three conferences and
yes,
doing something in relation to this plan change. I want him to focus on whatever he wants to focus on in terms of the ORC supplementary evidence. That's where everybody's put their main effort.
Yes.
It wasn't entirely necessary from my point of view that he then focus on everybody else's case, but, you know, if he has, that's fine. I think most other lawyers have just led that out of their witnesses. I don't want him coming back. We'll just keep it neat. He's just to focus on the substantive changes made by the Regional Council, and then he can come back separately on the schedule.
Okay.
All right. So when's he going to be ready?
I don't know. I'll find out from him.
Okay. So can we say Monday, 5 p.m?
That would be fine.
Very good. Thank you.
Would you like to swear on the Bible or affirm your identity?
Affirm.
Do you solemnly, sincerely and truly declare and affirm that in matter now before the court will speak the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth?
I do. Thank you.
Is your full name Sally Dicey?
It is.
And are you a resource management planner practising in Dunedin?
I am.
And do you have the qualifications and the experience set out in your paragraphs 1 to 8 of your evidence in chief dated the 5th of February?
I do.
And did you also prepare a supplementary brief of evidence dated the 19th of March?
I did.
And do you confirm that those briefs of evidence are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Now, Your Honour, I was intending to ask Ms. Dicey to read her summary from her February evidence.
Mm.
A lot of water has gone under the bridge since
Literally.
That time. And there may be limited utility
okay.
in that.
That's fine.
Ms. Dicey has this morning prepared an updated summary. Mm. We don't have physical copies
okay.
to give to the court and the parties yet, but I can obtain copies at the morning break
mm-hmm.
and have those handed up.
All right, so Ms. Dicey's reading, which will be entered into the record, but I think you're saying whatever she reads, she's not going to be ad-libbing to that? Or
no,
she,
no, yeah. no. She has a one-page written summary
mm-hmm.
That I can invite her to read
okay.
And then provide my friends in the court with hard copies.
Thank you.
Ms. Dicey, would you like to read your updated summary?
Sure. My evidence in chief explored whether an interim planning framework was required. I'm still of the opinion that the problem has been very poorly defined and characterised, both in the Skelton report and by the ORC. I am also still of the opinion that we have substantive, useful information to support and inform decision making. I also think that the gains achieved through reconsenting under the current operative regional plan to date have not been properly acknowledged. These have not simply been replacement of the status quo. However, as noted in my evidence in chief, I agree that the RPW, the operative plan, is out of date. I also recognise that the restricted discretionary pathway in the current plan is problematic, including that it does not allow for proper consideration of iwi values. I also agree that we have not yet identified what Te Mana o Te Wai means for Otago or how to give full expression to this in Otago. I was very concerned that PC7, as notified, did not provide a viable pathway at all for some permit holders, and that it did not effectively incentivise the controlled activity pathway or the rollover option. This was further exacerbated with the timing of notification, with the date for lodging applications to replace deemed permits, requiring applications to address both the operative RPW and PC7. In my opinion, any interim framework needs to incentivise a simple and efficient consent pathway to encourage and support as many permit holders as possible to take this option in order for it to be successful. I have proposed a controlled activity rule in my supplementary evidence that tries to achieve this. I still remain concerned that an interim framework delays environmental improvements, even when these may be critical, particularly where this involves a risk to threatened Indigenous species. This latter point has the potential to put PC7 in direct conflict with the MPSFM. This means that, in my opinion, there may be some circumstances where a substantive consent process may be justified or even desirable. To this end, I have proposed an objective policy and discretionary activity rule which tries to anticipate and allow for what might fall within this circumstance. I also think that the Section 128 power of review is a useful tool in the toolbox and can be utilised for any longer term permits that may be granted under PC7. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Darcy. I just have one
I have got one correction.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you tell us what that is?
In my evidence in chief, at paragraph 53...
So just wait for everybody to catch up.
Paragraph 53. Mm-hmm. I think it's the second sentence. It starts, "I do not agree." Mm-hmm. If you could strike out the word "not" after section 128 does not, the "not" should be taken out.
Gets rid of one question.
All right. Yeah. A critical knot in the wrong place.
It's one of those sentences with a double negative in it. All right. Thank you. Now, I want to ask you some questions arising from a discussion in court yesterday. Were you here yesterday afternoon when Ms. McIntyre gave her evidence?
Yes, I was.
And she expressed some concerns about the scope of things that might be able to be achieved through a Section 128 review process. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that discussion?
I do.
And two examples were discussed which were thought to be problematic under Section 128. The first is the potential to enable a change of take point from a tributary to the main stem of a water body. Mm-hmm. And the second was in relation to encouraging storage in mm-hmm. substitution for reliability of take from a water body.
But there was a third also, which is that if the new land and water plan introduces controls over land activities or controls in relation to land use, that too could be problematic in terms of trying to vary a water permit if indeed these are land use controls. So that was the third one that she'd noted. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I want to simply ask you to make comment on each of those as we work through mm-hmm. about how in practical terms when, as a planner, you represent an applicant, these issues are managed. So taking the first example then, where there might be benefit in shifting a take point from a tributary to the main stem, have you dealt with those kinds of issues before?
It was discussed, I think, as a possibility at some length in the Lindis case.
Yes. So what's the position with the consent holder in relation to that transition? Is that something which is it typically advanced by the consent holder or the council?
It's something that's advanced by the consent holder where they see that it might be beneficial to them. Yeah, and I would note as well that the transfer option exists now, both under the Act and under the current plan. And so that exploring that option is available right now for applicants.
Okay. And why would an applicant contemplate shifting a take point from a tributary to the main stem? What benefit would arise?
Typically, there would be an increase in reliability of supply for the consent holder.
And can you explain why that might be?
Flows in the main stem are often, particularly in Otago, often more stable than in some of the tribs. The tribs can have flashy flow profiles or can dry up. So that's obviously a general statement, but it does hold true for a lot of places. Sometimes it's not necessarily just a transfer from the trib to the main stem. Sometimes it's just a change in location along the same tributary as well.
Yeah. So have you ever come across a circumstance where a shift in take point from a trib to the main stem is something, an idea which is advanced by a council officer as opposed to the applicant?
No.
Can you think of any reason why an applicant might be opposed to the idea of relocating a take point from a trib to a main stem?
It can be cost related. At the moment, there's a big advantage if you have an existing take from a trib in that you can rely on a gravity to convey the water to your property. So that advantage is a historical one, obviously. And there are often costs associated with moving to the main stem. Even though a supply might be a lot better, the costs can be significant depending on the lay of the land. So the infrastructure might involve significant pumping infrastructure, piping infrastructure, which then, you know, has electricity costs associated to it too.
Okay. But if you were contemplating shifting from a gravity race and and contour flood type irrigation system to a pressurised spray system, mm-hmm. is the reliability of the point of take and where that is the kind of thing which gets addressed through infrastructure design?
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you. I want to now come to the second scenario, which is where it might be desirable to replace reliability of supply from the water body to replace that with stored water. Have you come across that scenario before?
Frequently, yep. There are policies within the plan and I think also within the RPS that encourage that.
Yes. So in a Section 128 review context, how would you see that issue playing out?
So a scenario where a consent holder doesn't already have storage, if a limit was imposed as a result of a review under Section 128, that might create, and that limit reduced access to water for that permit holder, then that might create an impetus to go down the path of storage to offset the loss of reliability from their take as a result of the limit.
Yeah.
So again, it would be a reaction or, and something undertaken by the applicant in response to a set of circumstances.
Yeah. So would you envisage the initiative to install storage to come from the applicant or from the regional council?
The applicant.
Yeah. I wonder if you are able to comment on the third scenario, which is that the Land and Water Regional Plan may introduce rules that control land use,
mm-hmm.
Where those rules don't currently exist,
mm-hmm.
and whether Section 128 review processes might be, or whether they deal with that circumstance.
So the Section 128 review, as I understand it, would enable a review relating to existing land use. I haven't actually applied my mind to it in terms of how you would apply to it, where there was previously no requirement for a land use consent. The applicant would be required to seek land use consent. That might have a corresponding effect on how they utilise infrastructure on their property.
Yeah.
And again, might be an impetus for them to change what they do on their property.
Yeah. Is it becoming common practice that replacement water permits are requiring the areas irrigated to be specified and mapped?
Yes.
Have you thought about whether a review of the conditions might be able to review the areas that are mapped pursuant to conditions of replaced permits?
I hadn't thought about that, no, but I think they could.
Thank you. Are there any supplementary matters, ma'am?
Thank you. Mr. Moore.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to start at the start today, not the end, so I'm a little bit confused still about what it is precisely that your evidence is in relation to whether you say PC7 is required or not. So in your summary this morning, you raised or flagged some concerns that you have with Plan Change 7, and then you provided your opinion in relation to how PC7 could be adjusted to address your concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Reading your supplementary evidence, I'm not clear as to whether or not you are saying that your primary opinion is that Plan Change 7 is not required. So are you able to assist my understanding?
Sure. I'm now of the opinion that an interim framework is necessary. I think consenting under the current plan, particularly within the RD rule, under the RD rule, is problematic. As I said already, I agree that the RPW is out of date, and actually consenting in that space is actually not good for anybody at the moment, stakeholders or applicants. So yes, I think an interim framework is inevitable, really.
I want to also understand the issues. Let's make sure I'm well and truly on the same page. So it's your opinion that there does need to be an interim framework.
Yeah.
The question now is, what does that framework look like?
Yeah.
In order to address the issues that have given rise to the need for Plan Change 7. Now, in relation to the submission that ORUG lodged, there were three options set out in terms of the relief that was sought, and mm-hmm. we've heard what I'll describe as a partial response from Council in relation to what's being pursued and what's not being pursued. And I just wanted to make sure I've understood what the position is, and I'm sure my friend will pop up if I've misunderstood. But the first... let's look at the three options. The three options, as I recall, there was an option one saying that PC7 should be deleted in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that whilst your opinion is that that relief is no longer appropriate, you are leaving, or ORUG's leaving, that relief on the table to provide some scope for some changes. If I understood that correctly?
That's pretty much my understanding, yes.
And then in relation to what is described as your options 2 and 3, if we look at the option 2 in the submission, that was a suite of relief seeking changes to the existing policies and methods in the plan. And my understanding is that that relief has now been abandoned on the basis that that wasn't a submission on Plan Change 7.
Yes, that's right.
And then in relation to your option 3 set out in the submission, this again was the option to bring in a permitted activity framework, but again within other parts of the operative plan. And again, both the permitted activity pathway, that option's been abandoned, but like the second option, the changes to the provisions to the other provisions of the plan, that's a submission beyond the scope of Plan Change 7. So my understanding is that options 2 and 3 have both been abandoned. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes.
So what we're left with then in terms of understanding the scope of the submission from ORUG is option 1 and the relief there simply that PC7 be deleted. And in relation to that issue, you've addressed the question of scope in your supplementary evidence in your paragraph 4.
Mm-hmm.
And in relation to these questions, I had understood that the issue of scope would have been addressed by your counsel at the invitation of the court. That hasn't happened, so I need to put some questions to you just to make sure I've understood what the position is. So you say in your paragraph 4 that you're relying on the relief from ORUG that Plan Change 7 be deleted in its entirety as a platform for inserting the changes that you are now recommending to be made. When you read a submission, when you're reading other parties' submissions, if a party had lodged a submission saying delete Plan Change 7, would you then consider that that party might, at a later point in time, seek a new objective and some new rules to be inserted into Plan Change 7?
The relief wasn't, when we made the submission, the relief wasn't just for decline, it was also some changes.
Now, those changes were set out in your options 2 and your options 3, weren't they?
That's right.
And those options have been abandoned, haven't they?
Yes.
So I'm just trying to understand the basis or the scope within which you say you can insert these new provisions that you're now recommending. And I'm just testing and flagging that this is an issue of concern because I am trying to understand where the scope arises in relation to these changes. But I think I understand your position and your opinion is that because ORUG saw that plan change 7 be declined, you think, or you say that there is scope then to make some changes to the framework?
Is that a question?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Now, that's as far as I need to take it with you. I'm just checking where your understanding is. It's ultimately a legal issue that will need to be resolved, but it's helpful to understand where you've come from in terms of these changes. And just to wrap that up, in terms of the objective that you are recommending to be inserted, and in relation to the discretionary activity rule, you say that the scope exists within the ORUG submission saying delete PC7 in its entirety.
At its very broadest, yes.
Yes. Now, I want to explore with you a little the changes that you have recommended to the planning framework. And I want to start with the objective that you are recommending to be inserted. Now, the version that I'm working through is to be found on page 20 of your supplementary evidence. And perhaps before we start this exercise, it might assist if you explain the tracking and the coding that you have used in this version so that we're all on the same page.
And sure.
I have a colour copy because I think the colour coding is also important.
Yes. So anything in the blue underline or blue strike through shaded in grey, and hopefully I've captured it all in grey, it gets a bit eye crossing, are my proposed changes.
And they are your proposed changes to what?
To, and I've recorded that on the front, if we just flip back to page 11. So at the bottom there, using Mr. De Palsmaker's version, recommended amendments marked in as at 14 March 2021, showing amendments to 4th March 2021 version. It was challenging to know which version would be best to use, because everybody's using different versions.
Yes, hence it's important to understand precisely what it is that you are changing. So when I read through this version, it's the text that's coloured blue and in a shaded box that indicates to me where you're recommending some changes compared to Mr. De Palsmaker's most recent version.
That's right.
Okay, well, let's have a look at your new objective 10A 1.2. I'd like to step up a level and just have you explain what it was you were trying to capture with that objective in terms of why you've recommended it be inserted.
It goes back to the concern I talked about in my summary that there are some things we potentially might not have 6 years to wait around for. And the critical one in the mix in Otago and with the deemed permits are threatened Indigenous species.
So what you're trying to capture in this objective is protection of threatened Indigenous species. Is that what you're aiming at?
It is. And then also acknowledging as well that if there is degradation that's happening and can clearly be seen to be happening, that it would be better to act with something than not at all.
Right. So let's see whether your wording gets us there in terms of that outcome. I just want to test and check that the sentiment that you're trying to express is captured in the wording. And the first part I'd like to pick up is in the second line in terms of freshwater where remedial action is required as soon as practicable. What's the frame of reference for understanding whether remedial action is required?
In this case, scientific information. So using science to identify where a threatened species is declining or maybe at risk of localised extinction.
So this objective is a purely science-based objective or just this part of the objective?
No, I'm aiming at the science basis here because we haven't yet done that broader analysis in Otago of how other values might be provided for. So it's in this sense is based on science, but can be informed by other knowledge where that knowledge is known and accepted as well.
Now, the objective then appears to be broadened out a little as we track through to protecting freshwater ecosystems. So we expand then beyond threatened species. Was it your intention to broaden the objective out to freshwater ecosystems?
Yes, with the intent of trying to capture, again, within the limited scope that we've got to do so at the moment, that tier one as much as possible from the NPS objective.
But again, as you said, through the lens of science, have I understood that correctly?
Yep.
So when we look at the phrase freshwater ecosystems, we should not be thinking about other values, the likes of cultural values or recreational values or amenity values?
It doesn't prevent that. So if there is sufficient information on the table about freshwater ecosystems linked to those values, then they can definitely be brought into the mix.
Doesn't this wording require that they be brought into the mix? Because it doesn't say only if there's information available in relation to some of these values.
Sorry, can you rephrase that?
Well, the phrase freshwater ecosystems, that's a very broad concept as we understand it. It's not simply dealing with ecosystem health or the subset of ecological values. You accept that freshwater ecosystems includes the full range of values?
I would be more inclined to limit it to the physical, the biophysical, ecological. Ecosystems and ecology is a science. So I think, my intent was, as I've already expressed, that this is more a science-based exercise at this stage. But if there are other values which can inform that and they're known in Otago and established, for example, through an RPS process or some of the FMU attribute states have been set at some point in the life of this, then they can be utilised as well.
So when we think about this objective through that lens, hanging off of it is... are a range of criteria for your discretionary activity role.
Yeah.
These are focused on the science, the core science attributes. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, they are. And that's in recognition, again, as I've said, is that we haven't gone through the full process to establish what te mana o te wai means in Otago, but that there can be some critical environmental aspects that are at risk that we may not have time to wait around for to fully flesh that out, and that will have to come into play as soon as possible, and the sooner the better. But until that's done, if there are critical things at play and science can help us with that, then I think we've got a duty to get on and use that science.
And hanging off of that discretionary activity rule is the ability to apply for 20-year permits?
Up to 20 years, that's right.
And so those values, and let's start with cultural values, they're simply not going to be considered for that 20-year period. if this objective in your discretionary activity role is framed up around the science values?
As a discretionary activity rule, cultural values can absolutely be a part of the assessment.
But your objective's not focused on that, is it?
No, it's not. That's right. But it also doesn't prevent consideration of that, of those other factors. And I would be open to including something in there. Just as Mr. Brass said yesterday, drafting in isolation is never going to lead to a perfectly drafted set of provisions. So I'd be very open to working through some of those issues with other parties.
And I appreciate you have gone to the trouble of putting some words forward, which means we can test whether the words are picking up and capturing the sentiment despite this process of doing so. So on that basis, you would see a need to broaden out your objective to ensure that other values weren't being excluded. Is that what I understand?
I don't see a need. I think I'm saying we'd be open to discussion around that and input from others. What this is trying to achieve is to focus on critical environmental aspects that we have enough knowledge to do something about and that we should be getting on and doing something about.
Is there a need for a 20-year permit to do that, or could that consideration occur through the lens of a 6-year permit?
You'll see at the bottom of my discretionary activity policy, I think it's subparagraph F, that there does include a requirement, and it's conjunctive, to exercise the replacement water permit on the terms proposed in the application would require substantial investment in new infrastructure. So there is a recognition in there that often with the scrutiny that happens at a consenting level and the conditions that come out of that, that substantive investment is likely to be required or will be required by the consent holder.
Now, I do have some questions about that, but we'll leave those questions as we work through the policy and the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps if I capture the sentiment there, you're saying that there might need to be a 20-year permit to reflect the investment made necessary to protect threatened species in this context.
Potentially, and I've said in my evidence as well that it is difficult to just pick a term out of thin air and to try and line it up, and I did explain why I've proposed 20 years. And ideally it would be lined up with any timeframes that the RPS come out with.
Right, I want to look now at the last part of the objective, and that says, or to halt or reverse degradation of an FMU or part of an FMU. Now, is it halting or reversing? What is it that's the target in relation to this objective?
Well, the way it's drafted, either.
Is that perhaps problematic when you think, when it comes to applying an objective such as this, which is, what is a decision maker to do? So if an applicant picks the easier path of saying, well, we're going to halt degradation, but we're not going to reverse it, that would fit within the objective?
I imagine it would be quite challenging for an applicant to put forward a proposal that can categorically just hold a line, given the dynamics of the natural environment that we're talking about, in terms of whether it's adding contaminants or managing contaminants, getting into waterways, flow levels and limits. So I think, and in my experience, it's always about going a step further to be on the safe side.
So when you say a step further, what do you mean? Do you mean an improvement? What do you mean there?
Often offering up a bit of a buffer in terms of whatever flow limit might be required, or whether in the past we're anticipating that farm environmental plans are put in place, well, we were anticipating with the deemed permit applications that they'd be replaced with farm environmental plans that then help that permit holder work through the effects of their land use. So it could be a broad range of things.
When you look at this objective, you accept that it's very hard to understand what some of these terms might mean in the absence of the work required to produce an NPS compliant land and water plan?
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think we have got some very clever people in the science space who hold a lot of information, who can tell us quite clearly, frequently, whether something is degrading. We heard from Dr. Olson yesterday, and I think he was very clear on where there was degradation in Otago in terms of water quality, and where that there are declining trends and where the hotspots were. So no, I don't think necessarily it's difficult.
There's some danger though in taking a pure science approach though, isn't there? When you read the NPS and the requirement now to understand different information systems, including the Tauranga Māori, mm-hmm. if one was simply to look at this objective through the lens of the science. Isn't this one of the problems with the current planning framework?
There are a whole lot of problems in the room, I think, including with trying to come up with an interim planning framework that does nothing. I think Mātauranga Māori will be an essential component for giving full expression to Tier 1 of the NPS across the country. But in the meantime, where you've got clearly degrading aspects of the environment or a threatened species, and we have the science to inform action, then I don't know why we wouldn't use that.
So in your view, the threatened species trump the consideration of cultural values for up to a 20-year period?
I don't think I would put it in simplistic terms like that. As I've said already, the term might be shifted to reflect the RPS, and the RPS should take account of cultural values. And I also anticipate that the review power will be something that will have to be used in Otago. And that's partly because in the Tairi we've already got 78% of allocation reconsented to 2037. I might have that date wrong, but for a considerable amount of time, I don't see how we can give effect to the NPS in a timely manner without using that tool in the toolbox.
Well, couldn't we give effect, or at least ensure that it can be given effect on a timely fashion, by having shorter term permits?
If we hand out shorter term permits and they don't account for degradation, and they don't account or try to address degradation or threatened species, I think that would be entirely inconsistent with the NPS.
Isn't the obligation on those using natural and physical resources to ensure that their adverse effects are appropriately addressed?
I don't think it's as simple as that in these cases. We are dealing with a highly dynamic resource where things are changing the interactions are complex, and I think a lot of resource users in isolation are not clear on what effect their particular water take is having on a particular group of galaxids, whether they even know that there is a galaxids population downstream or affected by their take necessarily until they enter this consent process. So what we see time and time again is that once you start along the path of a substantive consent process, there's a huge amount of learning by everybody involved. And that goes across the board. I've seen Mr. Hickey go out and come back from the field and say, wow, found a whole lot of galaxid populations and interactions and dry spots, and he can list off what's happened. Thompson's Creek is a great example for that. And so the consent holders are learning along with that process, and that is one of the huge advantages, I guess, of an intensive consent process. It allows all parties to come together, and you know, this it can sometimes take years to work through these issues and how all their interactions, how the deemed permits have been being managed, how they haven't, and priorities are being managed, how that's affected the characteristics, the impacts of shifting away from border diking to more efficient forms of irrigation. And often in our applications, we have to signal that we're not quite sure what that will mean for the environment, that shift.
So in relation to not quite understanding that shift, significant care needs to be taken in relation to the duration of consents granted, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and also review clauses, and sometimes adaptive management approach is really critical, and setting up through that consent process a really specific targeted set of monitoring conditions, and we have seen that come through the substantive consent process. So we've got galaxid management plans, we've got a whole suite of monitoring conditions that are pretty intensive and will be incredibly helpful for the next round of consenting, or will be useful to even inform a review.
So I want to move on to the policies now. So tracking down the page, policy 10, capital A, 2.1, and the first thing I want to ask you about is the first passage of struck out text, which I rather suspect is lacking some grey shading. Now, this is the deletion of the phrase irrespective of any other policies in this plan. Now, are you able just to confirm for me whether that strike out should have some grey shading underneath of it? As in, this is a recommendation you're making as part of this suite?
I think so, yes. I'll just check the clean. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
It appeared to my eye that it was, so I've simply highlighted it and written should be shaded beside that.
Yep.
So this is a change that you're recommending.
Yeah.
Now, I want to understand the purpose of that change. And as I understand, the purpose of the phrase irrespective of any other policies in this plan was to ensure that other policies weren't to be considered when working under this framework. What was the purpose of you deleting out that reference? Are you trying to bring back in all of the policies in the plan that relate to the subject matter?
No, that wasn't my intent.
So what was it? Why was the big red pen out for that, the blue pen, as the case may be?
I was taking out the word avoid. Was first and foremost, I think, with that, and just changing it to a grant, and that change was focused on the process-based, ensuring a process-based intent with the policy, with the interim planning framework, and encouraging as many people as possible, and making it as easy as possible for people to go down that pathway. As for the irrespective, I might have thought it was a good idea at the time I was tracking through.
So it wasn't your intent to bring back into play?
No, it wasn't, no.
Right, so the drafting would need to ensure that that wasn't the result of deleting those words.
Yeah.
Now, this policy is driving, to a large extent, the controlled activity rule, mm-hmm. although it does have some application for the discretionary activity rule. And one of the changes that I've observed in relation to this policy is that you have... I'll pick it up when we get to... Pick it up when we get to the next policy. Let's start with the deletion of the increase in the irrigation area. So you have recommended that there be no controls in relation to increases in irrigation areas in terms of the policy framework.
Yes.
And this framework, this policy will also be applying in relation to how non-complying activities are considered?
Yes.
And discretionary activities as well?
Yes.
So it's your opinion that there should not be any restriction on irrigable area in relation to this framework?
With the controlled activity rule, so this policy is more focused, in my mind, on the six-year permit, so the controlled activity pathway, and that could be tidied up if that's not clear enough. But I don't, again, coming back to the intent, if we want to maximise the number of people who choose this pathway, the number of permit holders to choose this pathway, it needs to be as process orientated as possible and as simple as possible. Any kind of requiring any kind of extra information can become a barrier. So an example with the increase in irrigated area, it sounds simple, I think, when you think of one farm and one property. So I deal with schemes which have 600 water users. Property is constantly being sold. Property is constantly being subdivided. They have everything from gardens outside pubs along the rail trail being irrigated, to commercial flowers, commercial nuts. And so going to every one of those shareholders and asking them to provide some form of proof, and I'm not sure what form of proof would be acceptable, just creates another barrier for so those kind of circumstances.
So it's your reasoning for excluding this matter of control is simply that it's inconvenient to the irrigators to have to express how much land they're irrigating?
No, that wasn't what I said at all. It was not about inconvenience. It was about if you want this planning framework to be effective from a process and make it as process orientated as possible, then you have to keep the controlled activity pathway as simple as possible. I also think that we've got an NES now which manages expansion, has identified where, you know, there are critical kind of concerns around water quality that may result from expansions of dairy or dairy support. So that's been controlled in the meantime through that, and that
Let's just press pause there. So one of the reasons you express for saying there's no risk or no concern with allowing irrigation area to increase is that you say the NES provides an adequate regulatory control.
I didn't say that there was no risk or no concern. Again, I come back to the intent, which is about a process pathway, a process-based pathway being incentivised. The other factor at play is permit holders in Otago are in a huge, possibly unprecedented state of uncertainty because of the shifting of goalposts almost at the last minute and the constant messaging that they're getting now that there will be a clawback of allocation. I think the risk of rampant expansion or even any expansion of significance is low in Otago at the moment.
Do you accept that there is an environmental risk associated with increasing irrigable area?
There can be, but it's not always a clear link. So if you're increasing a vineyard, for example, there would be a very, very low to negligible risk of creating adverse environmental effects resulting from that land use.
How about horticultural activities, apples, cherries?
Reasonably low.
But still an increase of nutrients when you look at the difference between irrigated versus unirrigated crops.
Yes.
And so there is a risk.
Although we do also have organic, quite a large amount of organic apples in the mix in the Manuhiri as well.
So what we're doing here is having to balance the risk of environmental degradation with the inconvenience to an irrigator of having to say, and this is how much land I'm currently irrigating. Isn't that what this comes down to?
Well, no, I wouldn't use the word inconvenience, no.
Well, it strikes me that you're saying that it's just too hard, it's just too much trouble for our irrigators to say how much land they're irrigating, and therefore we shouldn't have a control that protects the environment in this interim period.
No, I'm saying that it's not even clear in the drafting, the OSC's version of the rule, actually what evidence would be required or accepted.
So your concern is that there's a problem with how much evidence would be required as opposed to the underlying issue that's trying to be addressed?
The underlying issue that's trying to be addressed?
Which is a potential risk of environmental degradation over the six-year period within which these controlled activities will operate.
I thought I was worried about environmental degradation.
Well, you say that on the one hand, and yet you cross out a matter which has the potential to ensure that there isn't increased adverse effects associated with increased irrigable area.
So my focus in terms of environmental degradation is where it's clear, it can clearly be established in science, and that it's at a, you'll look at my discretionary activity policy, that it's at a catchment, looking at a catchment scale in that sense. Again, I think the risk of environmental degradation from expansion is very low.
And what evidence are you relying on in relation to that?
Central government's focus on expansion of dairy and dairy support, and my discussions with permit holders and their feeling of huge uncertainty. And so their reluctance, for many of them, I think, to want to expand.
So is it, strip all of that back, and let's say you've got an individual consent applicant using water abstracted pursuant to a deemed permit. If you say to that person, how much land are you irrigating? Are you saying to me that these farmers in this context won't be able to answer that question?
A single farmer will absolutely be able to answer that, yep.
Right, so if it's the individual farmers can answer that question, you then express some concerns with the irrigation companies and said, oh, it's all too hard for the irrigation companies to understand that as well. Isn't it just as simple? They simply ask their farmers, how much land is being irrigated?
Yes, but it's not just that's not just what's required of that policy. It's approved by a certain date, and I think that can be the complicating factor, is having the evidence or a clear evidence pathway to say that this block of flowers was in before this date or this area was developed. So that's part of my concern. It's just that, and again, it comes back to the intent. If we add complexity into that controlled activity pathway, you're at risk of people not wanting to take that pathway. So again, I come back to the intent of trying to create a controlled activity pathway that allows or that incentivises as many people as possible to take that pathway.
Right, so it's simply an issue of the complexity of the rule. That's at the heart of your concern, the complexity of the drafting, and you say it's too difficult for individual farmers and irrigation schemes to be able to say how much land was irrigated or the maximum land amount of land that was irrigated in that particular period of time.
It adds another threshold.
Right, I want to move on to the next alteration in that policy, and that is in relation to the deletion of reference to there being no increase in the actual instantaneous rate of abstraction. So you've, and it's subparagraph C of the policy, so you've recommended that be deleted in the context of the controlled activity rule. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes. And that lines up with the insertion at B, the proposed take is the direct replacement or otherwise reduces.
So you've set up in your framework is the ability for consent holders under the controlled activity framework to increase their irrigable area and use currently unused paper allocation, except that's the effect of the dual deletion of the irrigation restriction and this restriction?
Theoretically, yes, although it ignores the limiting factor in Otago. Often that paper water, more often than not, the vast majority of cases I'd go so far as to say, that paper water is paper water because it's not there to be taken.
But it could be. We've seen evidence in this hearing of deemed permit holders seeking to expand, saying they've got sufficient water, they simply haven't put the infrastructure in yet. This yep. leaves the door wide open for them, doesn't it?
Proposed the direct replacement. Yes, it does.
And that could have adverse effects on the environment during this period.
But yes, as could the continuation of existing any rollover permit will have adverse effects on the environment that aren't being managed.
Well, let's put it this way. It would have an additive effect in addition to the effects from rolling over permits.
Potentially. And I do go into some detail about that in my supplementary evidence where I talk about getting rid of paper water, and I'm not... it's a tricky one because I do think that there is some value in getting rid of that paper water and basing it on actual use. And so it's a weighing up in terms of, once again, the efficiency, simplicity of that controlled activity pathway and incentivising as many people as possible to go down that pathway, acknowledging that there could be a real clawback of their allocation regardless. So they might ramp up, but then under the new land and water plan, that could be taken off them. So
isn't that precisely what will happen if there are no controls at this point in time? There's an incentive for abstractors to take as much as they possibly can under their permits over the next five-year period to protect from the clawback when it eventually comes.
Well, theoretically, that's been happening under the existing plan already. And
so the mindset is out there that that is an approach to resource use?
No, I said theoretically. We've heard a lot of opinion about that, but I'm yet to see any evidence of it tabled. I would expect to see that playing out in water metering data. I don't see that. I think there's one or two outliers out there, but that's not what I see when I'm analysing applicants' water metering data. So I know that that is an opinion that has circulated in submissions and in some evidence from other parties, but I haven't actually seen anything tabled in terms of an array of water metering data which actually supports that. And once again, the limiting factor in Otago is the fact that the water just isn't there.
So why not ensure that the risk doesn't eventuate by restricting renewals to the actual use?
Yeah, and I discussed that in my supplementary evidence, and it's something, I definitely think it's something that could be considered, and I was actually initially in favour of it. It does tidy things up in the long term, potentially, so that under the Land and Water Regional Plan, theoretically we've got an easier starting point for our freshwater accounting. So you've got rid of all the white noise, theoretically, of paper water, because that adds a lot to the some of the consented max, so the primary allocation limits in Otago at the moment.
So that's the first benefit, and then the second benefit is it sends a very clear signal that there shouldn't be an increase in water abstraction over this period. Isn't that a second benefit?
So, yeah, just to finish what I was saying, I guess where I went, why I shifted from including that in the controlled activity rule was I think the benefits might be overstated in terms of, freshwater accounting in the future. I think we have a lot of that information already. We've pretty much lodged every application with paper water. And so within those applications, there's been an assessment and a understanding of what is paper water versus what is actual. That may shift depending on metering data over the next however many years and the Land and Water Regional Plan reconsenting under that. Excuse me. But I do think there's so much more complexity. Often getting rid of paper water through the application process often results in a really big reduction in annual volume, not necessarily so much in the rate, because people historically at some point will take up to their maximum rate of take. Flashy tribs or higher flows, they might coincide, it might rain in the headwaters of the catchment, might still be dry, they might maximise the water going past. And so where I'm getting to with this is that getting rid of some of those annual volumes, we still might have quite a high sum of consented max, but that still doesn't tell the whole story, because we have so many we have water going all over the show. We've got dams going down main stems, getting picked up into races, taking across a catchment, getting put into another sub-catchment. We've got retakes that aren't properly acknowledged as retakes, or with the way primary and supplementary allocation works, you might harvest that water in winter, but you might actually take it when the rivers at primary allocation flows. So there's a whole lot to untangle here. So in terms of this helping with the freshwater accounting, I think it probably actually won't be that helpful.
But if we keep this quite simple, ensuring that additional water is not taken over this next six-year period compared to the actual historic use, if we can achieve that through a crafted schedule which the experts are working on, isn't that the right thing to do by the environment?
I'm not opposed to it. I think if the schedule can be very clean and crisp and user-friendly, Again, it does mean we're going to have to analyse, my goodness, I don't know how many sets of water metering data to pivot with these applications from non-complying to controlled. So that is still quite a process and still quite a cost to get through the analysis of all of that again for what's theoretically supposed to be a rollover. It will add to the process required for a controlled activity pathway. I think we just need to be mindful of that.
All right, let's have a look at your policy, 10A 2.3. So we've dealt with the changes perhaps in terms of the first policy. So I've understood correctly, 10A 2.3 is the policy driving the discretionary activity rule. Is that conceptually, is that
yes.
its place?
Yes.
And this policy has a duration reference of 20 years in it?
As a maximum at the moment, yes.
Now this... policy doesn't provide any information in relation to the controlled activity. I'm just trying to understand its boundaries versus the controlled activity.
For the discretionary activity, yeah.
Yes. And what I'm struggling to find in the policy framework now is a policy that drives the six-year consenting for the controlled activity. So was that inadvertently removed out of the framework in terms of your drafting, or where is it that you're driving the six-year consenting for your controlled activity? Because it did used to hang off the end of this policy with the reference of no more than 6 years, which you'll see over the page.
Do you mean it used to hang off the... did it hang off the non-complying? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, no, that would have been inadvertent if that's what I've done.
So that would need to be picked up somewhere in the... that wasn't an intentional...
No, so very much still there needs to be a policy driving 6 years for the controlled activity rule, okay. if 6 years has landed on for that.
Right, I want to now look at the 20-year period and... Mm-hmm. I think you acknowledge in your evidence it's a little bit arbitrary in terms of the duration, mm-hmm. but I'm interested to understand why 20 years. 20 years is a fairly significant... well, do you accept that 20 years is a significant duration in the context of a water permit?
Yes, from a national perspective. Yeah, it is a step change for Otago historically.
You do work elsewhere in the country beyond the Otago region?
Yes, in Environment Canterbury as well.
And when you are working in that region, what's your understanding of the typical duration being applied to water permits?
15 years. I've seen it's quite typical.
You accept the range is 10 to 15?
You may know better than me.
So 20 years is an extension beyond what's happening at a national level. So why is it that you say 20 years is the appropriate length of time for these discretionary activities that aren't going to be taking into account, for example, cultural considerations?
So I did talk about this again in my supplementary evidence, that it is difficult to land on a particular term. Acknowledge, you know, what's happening around the country. I think in Otago there will be, in many cases, significant investment required to make a shift, because we are talking about kind of long-term historical land use activities, which may need to change, and that's anticipated and built into this policy that it is focusing on those kind of circumstances. So it was trying to take account of and allow for investment security to enable people to undertake enhancements or address critical threats along the way. But that may need to be reframed in light of the RPS and any timeframes that might come out in the RPS.
And therein lies a real challenge from a timing perspective, doesn't it? Because this rule will be potentially operative well before the RPS becomes operative, and a whole lot of consents may have been processed under this rule.
We will have hopefully a notified RPS pretty quickly.
And when you are preparing applications with a proposed RPS that hasn't been the subject of any challenge, what is it that you say about the weight that should be accorded to that instrument?
Don't give it too much weight.
Right. I want to understand now the balance of this policy, and I need first to understand the numbering, because I think the numbering's gone a little askew, and I'm not sure which bits hang off which bits, if that makes sense.
So, oh, no, look at that.
should the Roman numbers be replaced with an A, B, C and a D?
So this actually looks a lot better in the clean version, and this is the joy of working in a track change document. And perhaps it's just easier to look at this policy in that version, although it's split across two pages. It's page 48 and 49 of my...
What page?
48 and 49.
I don't have that. So I'm looking at a page 39, which seems to be your clean copy.
Yeah, so you've possibly got the version that I lodged without the methodology, which added extra pages.
I think I've got it. I've got a version dated the 19th of March.
Yes, but I think it's the methodology that's throwing that... So it's been slotted in.
There was an updated version of Ms. Dicey's supplementary file with the method included.
I was looking at that.
So there's no different beyond the page numbers in that respect.
Well, my page numbers wouldn't correlate with any policy, so we'll just grab another version.
Should be 63 pages long to be the right.
You've got 63 pages? Okay. No. As I understand it, there's no changes to the text that we've seen, perhaps some changes to the paragraph notations. The only substantial change to the latest draft of the 19th, which is 63 pages, is the insertion of the LAMPRO schedule.
That's right. And so, obviously, with the track change version, I hadn't picked up that there'd been some automatic formatting with the track changes. Apologies for that. And so, it's an easier version to possibly read the clean version.
Yes, except it doesn't have my highlighting and squiggle on, but we can work with that. just trying to understand how the nesting worked in relation
to... Do you want to take a break? And then you can make sure...
That might help.
And how long have we got for the break? Is it quarter of an hour? I'm just now conscious of the fact folk aren't going to get through their examination unless we make it a quick one. So we'll make it 15 minutes. Does that suit everybody? That's going to impact on your lunch, which will be well after 2 o'clock. Okay? All right, we'll do that. We'll take a 15-minute break now and you can reconcile your documents.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All rise.